Man, too. Grown such a fine, strong man. Grown so like what I knew he must be if it pleased God he was alive. She can ask, and he can answer, nothing connected for a time. All that time the old girl, turning away, leans one arm against the whitened wall, leans her honest forehead upon it, wipes her eyes with her serviceable grey cloak, and quite enjoys herself, like the best of old girls as she is.
"Mother," says the trooper, when they are more composed, "forgive me, first of all, for I know my need of it."
Forgive him. She does it with all her heart and soul. She always has done it. She tells him how she has had it written in her will these many years that he was her beloved son George. She has never believed any ill of him, never. If she had died without this happiness, and she is an old woman now and can't look to live very long, she would have blessed him with her last breath if she had had her senses as her beloved son George.
"Mother, I've been an undutiful trouble to you, and I have my reward. But of late years I've had a kind of glimmering of a purpose in me, too. When I left home I didn't care much, Mother. I'm afraid not a great deal, for leaving, and went away and listed, harum scarum, making believe to think that I cared for nobody, no, not I, and that nobody cared for me."
The trooper has dried his eyes and put away his handkerchief, but there is an extraordinary contrast between his habitual manner of expressing himself and carrying himself and the softened tone in which he speaks, interrupted occasionally by a half-stifled sob.
"So I wrote a line home, Mother, as you too well know, to say I had listed under another name, and I went abroad. Abroad, at one time, I thought I would write home next year, when I might be better off. And when that year was out, I thought I would write home next year, when I might be better off. When that year was out again, perhaps I didn't think much about it. So on, from year to year, through a service of 10 years, till I began to get older and to ask myself, why should I ever write?"
"I don't find any fault, child, but not to ease my mind, George. Not a word to your loving mother, who is growing older too."
This almost overturns the trooper afresh, but he sets himself up with a great, rough-sounding clearance of his throat.
"Heaven forgive me, Mother, but I thought there would be small consolation then in hearing anything about me. There were you, respected and esteemed. There was my brother, as I read in chance North Country papers now and then, rising to be prosperous and famous. And there was I, a dragoon, roving, unsettled, not self-made like him, but self-unmade. All my earlier advantages thrown away, all my little learning unlearnt. Nothing picked up but what unfitted me for most things that I could think of. What business had I to make myself known? After letting all that time go by me, what good could come of it? The worst was past with you, Mother. I knew by that time, being a man, how you had mourned for me and wept for me and prayed for me. And the pain was over, all was softened down, and I was better in your mind as it was."
The old lady sorrowfully shakes her head, and taking one of his powerful hands, lays it lovingly upon her shoulder.
"Oh, I don't say that it was so, Mother, but that I made it out to be so. I said just now, what good could come of it? Well, my dear Mother, some good might have come of it to myself, and there was the meanness of it. You would have sought me out. You would have purchased my discharge. You would have taken me down to Chesney Wold. You would have brought me and my brother and my brother's family together. You would all have considered anxiously how to do something for me and set me up as a respectable civilian. But how could any of you feel sure of me when I couldn't so much as feel sure of myself? How could you help regarding as an encumbrance and a discredit to you an idle dragooning chap who is an encumbrance and a discredit to himself, excepting under discipline? How could I look my brother's children in the face and pretend to set them an example? I, the vagabond boy who had run away from home and been the grief and unhappiness of my mother's life. No, George, such were my words, Mother, when I passed this in review before me. You have made your bed, now lie upon it."
Mrs. Rouncewell, drawing up her stately form, shakes her head at the old girl with a swelling pride upon her, as much as to say, "I told you so." The old girl relieves her feelings and testifies her interest in the conversation by giving the trooper a great poke between the shoulders with her umbrella. This action she afterwards repeats at intervals, in a species of affectionate lunacy, never failing, after the administration of each of these remonstrances, to resort to the whitened wall and the grey cloak again.
This was the way I brought myself to think, mother, that my best amends was to lie upon that bed I had made, and die upon it. And I should have done it, though I have been to see you more than once down at Chesney Wold when you little thought of me. But for my old comrade's wife here, who I find has been too many for me. But I thank her for it. I thank you for it, Mrs. Bagnet, with all my heart and might.
To which Mrs. Bagnet responds with two pokes. And now the old lady impresses upon her son George, her own dear recovered boy, her joy and pride, the light of her eyes, the happy close of her life, and every fond name she can think of, that he must be governed by the best advice obtainable by money and influence, that he must yield up his case to the greatest lawyers that can be got, that he must act in this serious plight as he shall be advised to act, and must not be self-willed, however right, but must promise to think only of his poor old mother's anxiety and suffering until he is released, or he will break her heart.
"Mother, 'tis little enough to consent to,"
returns the trooper, stopping her with a kiss.
"Tell me what I shall do, and I'll make a late beginning and do it. Mrs. Bagnet, you'll take care of my mother, I know."
A very hard poke from the old girl's umbrella.
"If you'll bring her acquainted with Mr. Jarndyce and Miss Summerson, she will find them of her way of thinking, and they will give her the best advice and assistance."
"And George," says the old lady, "we must send with all haste to your brother. He is a sensible, sound man, as they tell me, out in the world beyond Chesney Wold, my dear, though I don't know much of it myself, and will be of great service."
"Mother,"
returns the trooper,
"is it too soon to ask a favour?"
"Surely not, my dear."
"Then grant me this one great favour. Don't let my brother know."
"Not know what, my dear?"
"Not know of me. In fact, mother, I can't bear it. I can't make up my mind to it. He has proved himself so different from me, and has done so much to raise himself, while I've been soldiering, that I haven't brass enough in my composition to see him in this place and under this charge. How can a man like him be expected to have any pleasure in such a discovery? It's impossible. No, keep my secret from him, mother. Do me a greater kindness than I deserve, and keep my secret from my brother, of all men."
"But not always, dear George."
"Why, mother, perhaps not for good and all, though I may come to ask that too. But keep it now, I do entreat you. If it's ever broke to him that his rip of a brother has turned up, I could wish,"
says the trooper, shaking his head very doubtfully,
"to break it myself and be governed as to advancing or retreating by the way in which he seems to take it."
As he evidently has a rooted feeling on this point, and as the depth of it is recognised in Mrs. Bagnet's face, his mother yields her implicit assent to what he asks. For this he thanks her kindly.
"In all other respects, my dear mother, I'll be as tractable and obedient as you can wish. On this one alone I stand out. So now I am ready even for the lawyers. I've been drawing up,"
he glances at his writing on the table,
"an exact account of what I knew of the deceased, and how I came to be involved in this unfortunate affair. It's entered plain and regular like an orderly book. Not a word in it but what's wanted for the facts. I did intend to read it straight on end, whensoever I was called upon to say anything in my defence. I hope I may be let to do it still, but I have no longer a will of my own in this case, and whatever is said and done, I give my promise not to have any."
Matters being brought to this so far satisfactory pass, and time being on the wane, Mrs. Bagnet proposes a departure. Again and again the old lady hangs upon her son's neck, and again the trooper holds her to his broad chest.
"Where are you going to take my mother, Mrs. Bagnet?"
"I'm going to the townhouse, my dear. The family house. I have some business there that must be looked to directly," Mrs. Rouncewell answers.
"Will you see my mother safe there in a coach, Mrs. Bagnet? But of course I know you will. Why should I ask it?"
"Why indeed," Mrs. Bagnet expresses with the umbrella.
"Take her, my old friend, and take my gratitude along with you. Kisses to Quebec and Malta, love to my godson, a hearty shake of the hand to Lignum, and this for yourself. And I wish it was £10,000 in gold, my dear."
So saying, the trooper puts his lips to the old girl's tanned forehead, and the door shuts upon him in his cell. No entreaties on the part of the good old housekeeper will induce Mrs. Bagnet to retain the coach for her own conveyance home. Jumping out cheerfully at the door of the Dedlock mansion, and handing Mrs. Rouncewell up the steps, the old girl shakes hands and trudges off, arriving soon afterwards in the bosom of the Bagnet family, and falling to washing the greens, as if nothing had happened. My lady is in that room in which she held her last conference with the murdered man, and is sitting where she sat that night, and is looking at the spot where he stood upon the hearth, studying her so leisurely, when a tap comes at the door. Who is it? Mrs. Rouncewell. What has brought Mrs. Rouncewell to town so unexpectedly?
Trouble, my lady. Sad trouble. Oh, my lady, may I beg a word with you?
What new occurrence is it that makes this tranquil old woman tremble so? Far happier than her lady, as her lady has often thought, why does she falter in this manner and look at her with such strange mistrust?
What is the matter? Sit down and take your breath. Oh, my lady, I have found my son, my youngest, who went away for a soldier so long ago, and he is in prison.
For debt?
Oh, no, my lady, I would have paid any debt and joyful.
For what is he in prison, then?
Charged with a murder, my lady, of which he is as innocent as I am, accused of the murder of Mr. Tulkinghorn.
What does she mean by this look and this imploring gesture? Why does she come so close? What is the letter that she holds?
Lady Dedlock, my dear lady, my good lady, my kind lady, you must have a heart to feel for me. You must have a heart to forgive me. I was in this family before you were born. I am devoted to it. But think of my dear son wrongfully accused.
I do not accuse him.
No, my lady, no, but others do, and he is in prison and in danger. Oh, Lady Dedlock, if you can say but a word to help to clear him, say it.
What delusion can this be? What power does she suppose is in the person she petitions to avert this unjust suspicion, if it be unjust? Her lady's handsome eyes regard her with astonishment, almost with fear.
My lady, I came away last night from Chesney Wold to find my son in my old age, and the step upon the Ghost's Walk was so constant and so solemn that I never heard the like in all these years. Night after night, as it has fallen dark, the sound has echoed through your rooms. But last night it was awfulest, and as it fell dark last night, my lady, I got this letter.
What letter is it?
Hush, hush.
The housekeeper looks round and answers in a frightened whisper,
My lady, I have not breathed a word of it. I don't believe what's written in it. I know it can't be true. I'm sure and certain that it is not true, but my son is in danger, and you must have a heart to pity me. If you know of anything that is not known to others, if you have any suspicion, if you have any clue at all, and any reason for keeping it in your own breast, oh, my dear lady, think of me, and conquer that reason, and let it be known. This is the most I consider possible. I know you are not a hard lady, but you go your own way always without help, and you are not familiar with your friends, and all who admire you, and all do, as a beautiful and elegant lady, know you to be one far from themselves who can't be approached close. My lady, you may have some proud or angry reasons for disdaining to utter something that you know. If so, pray, oh, pray think of a faithful servant whose whole life has been passed in this family, which she dearly loves, and relent, and help to clear my son. My lady, my good lady.
The old housekeeper pleads with genuine simplicity.
I am so humble in my place, and you are by nature so high and distant, that you may not think what I feel for my child, but I feel so much that I have come here to make so bold as to beg and pray you not to be scornful of us, if you can do us any right or justice at this fearful time.
Lady Dedlock raises her without one word, until she takes the letter from her hand.
Am I to read this? When I am gone, my lady, if you please, and then remembering the most that I consider possible.
I know of nothing I can do. I know of nothing I reserve that can affect your son. I have never accused him.
My lady, you may pity him the more under a false accusation after reading the letter.
The old housekeeper leaves her with the letter in her hand. In truth, she is not a hard lady naturally, and the time has been when the sight of the venerable figure suing to her with such strong earnestness would have moved her to great compassion. But so long accustomed to suppress emotion and keep down reality, so long schooled for her own purposes in that destructive school which shuts up the natural feelings of the heart like flies in amber, and spreads one uniform and dreary gloss over the good and bad, the feeling and the unfeeling, the sensible and the senseless, she had subdued even her wonder until now. She opens the letter. Spread out upon the paper is a printed account of the discovery of the body as it lay face downward on the floor, shot through the heart, and underneath is written her own name with the word murderess attached. It falls out of her hand. How long it may have lain upon the ground she knows not, but it lies where it fell, when a servant stands before her, announcing the young man of the name of Guppy. The words have probably been repeated several times, for they are ringing in her head before she begins to understand them.
"Let him come in."
He comes in, holding the letter in her hand, which she has taken from the floor. She tries to collect her thoughts. In the eyes of Mr. Guppy she is the same Lady Dedlock, holding the same prepared, proud, chilling state.
"Your ladyship may not be at first disposed to excuse this visit from one who has never been welcome to your ladyship,
which he don't complain of, for he is bound to confess that there never has been any particular reason on the face of things why he should be. But I hope when I mention my motives to your ladyship, you will not find fault with me," says Mr. Guppy.
"Do so." "Thank your ladyship. I ought first to explain to your ladyship."
Mr. Guppy sits on the edge of a chair and puts his hat on the carpet at his feet.
"That Miss Summerson, whose image, as I formerly mentioned to your ladyship, was at one period of my life imprinted on my art, until erased by circumstances over which I had no control, communicated to me, after I had the pleasure of waiting on your ladyship last, that she particularly wished me to take no steps whatever in any manner at all relating to her, and Miss Summerson's wishes being to me a law, except as connected with circumstances over which I have no control, I consequently never expected to have the distinguished honour of waiting on your ladyship again."
"And yet he is here now," Lady Dedlock moodily reminds him.
"And yet I'm here now," Mr. Guppy admits, "my object being to communicate to your ladyship, under the seal of confidence, why I am here."
"He cannot do so," she tells him, "too plainly or too briefly."
"Nor can I," Mr. Guppy returns, with a sense of injury upon him, "too particularly request your ladyship to take particular notice that it's no personal affair of mine that brings me here. I have no interested views of my own to serve in coming here. If it was not for my promise to Miss Summerson and my keeping of it sacred, I, in point of fact, shouldn't have darkened these doors again, but should have seen him further first."
Mr. Guppy considers this a favourable moment for sticking up his hair with both hands.
"Your ladyship will remember when I mention it, that the last time I was here I run against a party very eminent in our profession, and whose loss we all deplore. That party certainly did from that time apply himself to cutting in against me in a way that I will call sharp practice, and did make it, at every turn and point, extremely difficult for me to be sure that I hadn't inadvertently led up to something contrary to Miss Summerson's wishes. Self-praise is no recommendation, but I may say for myself that I'm not so bad a man of business neither."
Lady Dedlock looks at him in stern inquiry. Mr. Guppy immediately withdraws his eyes from her face and looks anywhere else.
"Indeed, it has been made so hard," he goes on, "to have any idea what that party was up to in combination with others, that until the loss, which we all deplore, I was gravelled,"
an expression which your ladyship, moving in the higher circles, will be so good as to consider tantamount to "knocked over." "Small, likewise, a name by which I refer to another party, a friend of mine that your ladyship is not acquainted with, got to be so close and double-faced that at times it wasn't easy to keep one's hands off his head. However, what with the exertion of my humble abilities, and what with the help of a mutual friend by the name of Mr. Tony Weevil, who is of high aristocratic turn and has your ladyship's portrait always hanging up in his room, I have now reasons for an apprehension as to which I come to put your ladyship upon your guard. First, will your ladyship allow me to ask you whether you have had any strange visitors this morning? I don't mean fashionable visitors, but such visitors, for instance, as Miss Barbary's old servant, or as a person without the use of his lower extremities, carried upstairs similarly to a guy?"
"No."
"Then I assure your ladyship that such visitors have been here, and have been received here, because I saw them at the door, and waited at the corner of the square till they came out, and took half an hour's turn afterwards to avoid them."
"What have I to do with that? Or what have you? I do not understand you. What do you mean?"
"Your ladyship, I come to put you on your guard. There may be occasion for it."
"Very well. Then I have only done my best to keep my promise to Miss Summerson. I strongly suspect, from what Small has dropped, and from what we have corkscrewed out of him, that those letters I was to have brought to your ladyship were not destroyed when I supposed they were, that if there was anything to be blown upon, it is blown upon, that the visitors I have alluded to have been here this morning to make money of it, and that the money is made or making."
Mr. Guppy picks up his hat and rises.
"Your ladyship,
You know best whether there's anything in what I say, or whether there's nothing. Something or nothing, I have acted up to Miss Summerson's wishes in letting things alone, and in undoing what I had begun to do, as far as possible. That's sufficient for me. In case I should be taking a liberty and putting your ladyship on your guard when there's no necessity for it, you will endeavour, I should hope, to outlive my presumption, and I shall endeavour to outlive your disapprobation. I now take my farewell of your ladyship, and assure you that there's no danger of your ever being waited on by me again. She scarcely acknowledges these parting words by any look, but when he has been gone a little while, she rings her bell.
Where is Sir Leicester?
Mercury reports that he is at present shut up in the library alone.
Has Sir Leicester had any visitors this morning?
Several, on business. Mercury proceeds to a description of them, which has been anticipated by Mr. Guppy. Enough, he may go. So, all is broken down. Her name is in these many mouths, her husband knows his wrongs, her shame will be published, may be spreading while she thinks about it, and in addition to the thunderbolt so long foreseen by her, so unforeseen by him, she is denounced by an invisible accuser as the murderess of her enemy. Her enemy he was, and she has often, often, often wished him dead. Her enemy he is even in his grave. This dreadful accusation comes upon her like a new torment at his lifeless hand. And when she recalls how she was secretly at his door that night, and how she may be represented to have sent her favourite girl away so soon before, merely to release herself from observation, she shudders as if the hangman's hands were at her neck. She has thrown herself upon the floor, and lies with her hair all wildly scattered, and her face buried in the cushions of a couch. She rises up, hurries to and fro, flings herself down again, and rocks and moans. The horror that is upon her is unutterable. If she really were the murderess, it could hardly be, for the moment, more intense. For as her murderous perspective, before the doing of the deed, however subtle the precautions for its commission, would have been closed up by a gigantic dilatation of the hateful figure, preventing her from seeing any consequences beyond it. And as those consequences would have rushed in an unimagined flood, the moment the figure was laid low, which always happens when a murder is done. So, now she sees that when he used to be on the watch before her, and she used to think, if some mortal stroke would but fall on this old man and take him from my way, it was but wishing that all he held against her in his hand might be flung to the winds, and chance sown in many places. So, too, with the wicked relief she has felt in his death. What was his death but the keystone of a gloomy arch removed? And now the arch begins to fall in a thousand fragments, each crushing and mangling piecemeal. Thus, a terrible impression steals upon and overshadows her that from this pursuer, living or dead, obdurate and imperturbable before her in his well-remembered shape, or not more obdurate and imperturbable in his coffin bed, there is no escape but in death. Hunted, she flies. The complication of her shame, her dread, remorse, and misery overwhelms her at its height, and even her strength of self-reliance is overturned and whirled away like a leaf before a mighty wind. She hurriedly addresses these lines to her husband, seals, and leaves them on her table. If I am sought for, or accused of his murder, believe that I am wholly innocent. Believe no other good of me, for I am innocent of nothing else that you have heard or will hear laid to my charge. He prepared me on that fatal night for his disclosure of my guilt to you. After he had left me, I went out on pretense of walking in the garden where I sometimes walk, but really to follow him and make one last petition that he would not protract the dreadful suspense on which I have been racked by him, you do not know how long, but would mercifully strike next morning. I found his house dark and silent. I rang twice at his door, but there was no reply, and I came home. I have no home left. I will encumber you no more. May you, in your just resentment, be able to forget the unworthy woman on whom you have wasted a most generous devotion, who avoids you only with a deeper shame than that with which she hurries from herself, and who writes this last adieu. She veils and dresses quickly, leaves all her jewels and her money, listens, goes downstairs at a moment when the hall is empty, opens and shuts the great door, flutters away in the shrill, frosty wind. Chapter 56. Pursuit. Impassive, as behoves its high breeding,
The deadlock townhouse stares at the other houses in the street of dismal grandeur and gives no outward sign of anything going wrong within. Carriages rattle. Doors are battered at. The world exchanges calls. Ancient charmers with skeleton throats and peachy cheeks that have a rather ghastly bloom upon them seen by daylight, when indeed these fascinating creatures look like death and the lady fused together, dazzle the eyes of men. Forth from the frigid mews come easily swinging carriages, guided by short-legged coachmen in flaxen wigs, deep-sunk into downy hammercloths, and up behind mount luscious mercuries bearing sticks of state, and wearing cocked hats broadwise, a spectacle for the angels. The deadlock townhouse changes not externally, and hours pass before its exalted dullness is disturbed within. But Volumnia the Fair, being subject to the prevalent complaint of boredom, and finding that disorder attacking her spirits with some virulence, ventures at length to repair to the library for change of scene. A gentle tapping at the door producing no response, she opens it and peeps in. Seeing no one there, she takes possession. The sprightly deadlock is reputed, in that grass-grown city of the ancients, Bath, to be stimulated by an urgent curiosity which impels her on all convenient and inconvenient occasions to sidle about with a golden glass at her eye, peering into objects of every description. Certain it is that she avails herself of the present opportunity of hovering over her kinsman's letters and papers like a bird, taking a short peck at this document, and a blink with her head on one side at that document, and hopping about from table to table with her glass at her eye in an inquisitive and restless manner. In the course of these researches, she stumbles over something, and turning her glass in that direction, sees her kinsman lying on the ground like a felled tree. Volumnia's pet little scream acquires a considerable augmentation of reality from this surprise, and the house is quickly in commotion. Servants tear up and down stairs, bells are violently rung, doctors are sent for, and Lady Dedlock is sought in all directions, but not found. Nobody has seen or heard her since she last rang her bell. Her letter to Sir Leicester is discovered on her table, but it is doubtful yet whether he has not received another missive from another world requiring to be personally answered, and all the living languages and all the dead are as one to him. They lay him down upon his bed and chafe and rub and fan, and put ice to his head, and try every means of restoration. Howbeit the day has ebbed away, and it is night in his room before his stertorous breathing lulls, or his fixed eyes show any consciousness of the candle that is occasionally passed before them. But when this change begins, it goes on. And by and by he nods, or moves his eyes, or even his hand in token that he hears and comprehends. He fell down this morning, a handsome, stately gentleman, somewhat infirm, but of a fine presence, and with a well-filled face. He lies upon his bed, an aged man with sunken cheeks, the decrepit shadow of himself. His voice was rich and mellow, and he had so long been thoroughly persuaded of the weight and import to mankind of any word he said, that his words really had come to sound as if there were something in them. But now he can only whisper, and what he whispers sounds like what it is, mere jumble and jargon. His favourite and faithful housekeeper stands at his bedside. It is the first act he notices, and he clearly derives pleasure from it. After vainly trying to make himself understood in speech, he makes signs for a pencil, so inexpressively that they cannot at first understand him. It is his old housekeeper who makes out what he wants, and brings in a slate. After pausing for some time, he slowly scrawls upon it in a hand that is not his.
"Chesney Wold?"
"No," she tells him. "He is in London. He was taken ill in the library this morning." Right thankful she is that she happened to come to London and is able to attend upon him. "It is not an illness of any serious consequence, Sir Leicester. You will be much better tomorrow, Sir Leicester. All the gentlemen say so." This, with the tears coursing down her fair old face. After making a survey of the room and looking with particular attention all round the bed where the doctors stand, he writes,
"My lady."
"My lady went out, Sir Leicester, before you were taken ill, and don't know of your illness yet." He points again, in great agitation, at the two words. They all try to quiet him, but he points again with increased agitation. On their looking at one another, not knowing what to say, he takes the slate once more and writes,
"My lady, for God's sake, where?"
and makes an imploring moan. It is thought better that his old housekeeper should give him Lady Dedlock's letter, the contents of which no one knows or can surmise. She opens it for him and puts it out for his perusal. Having read it twice by a great effort, he turns it down so that it shall not be seen, and lies moaning. He passes into a kind of relapse, or into a swoon, and it is an hour before he opens his eyes, reclining on his faithful and attached old servant's arm. The doctors know that he is best with her, and when not actively engaged about him, stand aloof. The slate comes into requisition again, but the word he wants to write he cannot remember. His anxiety, his eagerness, and affliction at this pass are pitiable to behold. It seems as if he must go mad in the necessity he feels for haste, and the inability under which he labours of expressing to do what or to fetch whom. He has written the letter B, and there stopped. Of a sudden, in the height of his misery, he puts Mr. before it. The old housekeeper suggests Bucket. Thank heaven, that's his meaning. Mr. Bucket is found to be downstairs, by appointment. Shall he come up? There is no possibility of misconstruing Sir Leicester's burning wish to see him, or the desire he signifies to have the room cleared of everyone but the housekeeper. It is speedily done, and Mr. Bucket appears. Of all men upon earth, Sir Leicester seems fallen from his high estate to place his sole trust and reliance upon this man. "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I'm sorry to see you like this. I hope you'll cheer up. I'm sure you will, on account of the family credit." Sir Leicester puts her letter in his hands, and looks intently in his face while he reads it. A new intelligence comes into Mr. Bucket's eye as he reads on. With one hook of his finger, while that eye is still glancing over the words, he indicates, "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I understand you." Sir Leicester writes upon the slate,
"Full forgiveness. Find—"
Mr. Bucket stops his hand. "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I'll find her. But my search after her must be begun out of hand. Not a minute must be lost." With the quickness of thought, he follows Sir Leicester Dedlock's look towards a little box upon a table. "Bring it here, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet?" "Certainly." "Open it with one of these here keys?" "Certainly." "The littlest key?" "To be sure. Take the notes out?" "So I will. Count them?" "That's soon done. 20 and 30 is 50 and 20 is 70 and 50 is 120 and 40 is 160. "Take them for expenses?" "That I'll do. And render an account, of course." "Don't spare money?" "No, I won't." The velocity and certainty of Mr. Bucket's interpretation on all these heads is little short of miraculous. Mrs. Rouncewell, who holds the light, is giddy with the swiftness of his eyes and hands as he starts up furnished for his journey. "You're George's mother, old lady. That's about what you are, I believe," says Mr. Bucket aside, with his hat already on and buttoning his coat. "Yes, sir. I'm his distressed mother." "So I thought, according to what he mentioned to me just now. Well, then I'll tell you something. You needn't be distressed no more. Your son's all right. Now don't you begin a-crying, because what you've got to do is to take care of Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, and you won't do that by crying. As to your son, he's all right, I tell you, and he sends his loving duty and hoping you're the same. He's discharged honourable, that's about what he is, with no more imputation on his character than there is on yours, and yours is a tidy one, I'll bet a pound. You may trust me, for I took your son. He conducted himself in a game way, too, on that occasion, and he's a fine-made man, and you're a fine-made old lady, and you're a mother and son, the pair of you, as might be showed for models in a caravan. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, what you've trusted to me I'll go through with. Don't you be afraid of my turning out of my way, right or left, or taking a sleep, or a wash, or a shave, till I have found what I go in search of. Say everything as is kind and forgiving on your part. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, I will. And I wish you better, and these family affairs smoothed over, as, Lord, many other family affairs equally has been, and equally will be, to the end of time." With this peroration, Mr. Bucket, buttoned up, goes quietly out, looking steadily before him as if he were already piercing the night in quest of the fugitive. His first step is to take himself to Lady Dedlock's rooms, and look all over them for any trifling indication that may help him. The rooms are in darkness now, and to see Mr. Bucket, with a wax light in his hand, holding it above his head and taking a sharp mental inventory of the many delicate objects so curiously at variance with himself, would be to see a sight, which nobody does see, as he is particular to lock himself in. "A spicy boudoir, this," says Mr. Bucket, who feels in a manner furbished up in his French by the blow of the morning. "Must have cost a sight of money. rum articles to cut away from, these. She must have been hard put to it. Opening and shutting table drawers, and looking into caskets and jewel cases, he sees the reflection of himself in various mirrors and moralizes thereon. "One might suppose I was a-moving in the fashionable circles and getting myself up for Almack's," says Mr. Bucket. "I begin to think I must be a swell in the guards without knowing it." Ever looking about, he has opened a dainty little chest in an inner drawer. His great hand, turning over some gloves, which it can scarcely feel, they are so light and soft within it, comes upon a white handkerchief. "Let's have a look at you," says Mr. Bucket, putting down the light. "What should you be kept by yourself for? What's your motive? Are you her ladyship's property or somebody else's? You've got a mark upon you somewheres or another, I suppose?" He finds it, as he speaks. Esther Summerson. "Oh," says Mr. Bucket, pausing with his finger at his ear. "Come, I'll take you." He completes his observations as quietly and carefully as he has carried them on, leaves everything else precisely as he found it, glides away after some 5 minutes in all, and passes into the street. With a glance upward at the dimly lighted windows of Sir Leicester's room, he sets off, full swing, to the nearest coach stand, picks out the horse for his money, and directs to be driven to the shooting gallery. Mr. Bucket does not claim to be a scientific judge of horses, but he lays out a little money on the principal events in that line, and generally sums up his knowledge of the subject in the remark that when he sees a horse as can go, he knows him. His knowledge is not at fault in the present instance. Clattering over the stones at a dangerous pace, yet thoughtfully bringing his keen eyes to bear on every slinking creature whom he passes in the midnight streets, and even on the lights in upper windows where people are going or gone to bed, and on all the turnings that he rattles by, and alike on the heavy sky, and on the earth where the snow lies thin, for something may present itself to assist him anywhere, he dashes to his destination at such a speed that when he stops, the horse half smothers him in a cloud of steam. "I'll bear him off a moment to freshen him up, and I'll be back." He runs up the long wooden entry and finds the trooper smoking his pipe. "I thought I should, George, after what you've gone through, my lad. I haven't a word to spare. Now, honour, ought to save a woman. Miss Summerson that was here when Gridley died. That was the name, I know. All right, where does she live?" The trooper has just come from there and gives him the address, near Oxford Street. "You won't repent it, George. Good night." He is off again, with an impression of having seen Phil sitting by the frosty fire staring at him open-mouthed, and gallops away again and gets out in a cloud of steam again. Mr. Jarndyce, the only person up in the house, is just going to bed, rises from his book on hearing the rapid ringing at the bell, and comes down to the door in his dressing-gown. "Don't be alarmed, sir." In a moment his visitor is confidential with him in the hall, has shut the door, and stands with his hand upon the lock. "I've had the pleasure of seeing you before. Inspector Bucket. Look at that handkerchief, sir. Miss Esther Summerson's. Found it myself, put away in a drawer of Lady Dedlock's 1/4 hour ago. Not a moment to lose, matter of life or death. You know Lady Dedlock?"
"Yes."
"There has been a discovery there today. Family affairs have come out. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, has had a fit, apoplexy or paralysis, and couldn't be brought to, and precious time has been lost. Lady Dedlock disappeared this afternoon and left a letter for him that looks bad. Run your eye over it. Here it is." Mr. Jarndyce, having read it, asks him what he thinks.
"I don't know. It looks like suicide. Anyways, there's more and more danger every minute of its drawing to that. I give £100 an hour to have got the start of the present time. Now, Mr. Jarndyce, I'm employed by Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, to follow her and find her, to save her and take her his forgiveness. I have money and full power, but I want something else. I want Miss Summerson."
Mr. Jarndyce, in a troubled voice, repeats, "Miss Summerson?" "Now, Mr. Jarndyce," Mr. Bucket has read his face with the greatest attention all along, "I'll speak to you as a gentleman of a humane heart, and under such pressing circumstances as don't often happen. If ever delay was dangerous, it's dangerous now, and if ever you couldn't afterwards forgive yourself for causing it, this is the time. 8 or 10 hours worth, as I tell you, £100 apiece at least, have been lost since Lady Dedlock disappeared. I am charged to find her. I am Inspector Bucket. Besides all the rest that's heavy on her, she has upon her, as she believes, a suspicion of murder. If I follow her alone, she, being in ignorance of what Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, has communicated to me, may be driven to desperation. But if I follow her in company with a young lady, answering to the description of a young lady that she has a tenderness for, I ask no question, and I say no more than that, she will give me credit for being friendly. Let me come up with her and be able to have the hold upon her of putting that young lady forward,
and I'll save her and prevail with her if she is alive. Let me come up with her alone, a hard matter, and I'll do my best, but I don't answer for what the best may be. Time flies. It's getting on for 1 o'clock. When one strikes, there's another hour gone, and it's worth £1,000 now instead of 100. This is all true, and the pressing nature of the case cannot be questioned. Mr. Jarndyce begs him to remain there while he speaks to Miss Summerson. Mr. Bucket says he will, but acting on his usual principle does no such thing, following upstairs instead and keeping his man in sight. So he remains, dodging and lurking about in the gloom of the staircase while they confer. In a very little time Mr. Jarndyce comes down and tells him that Miss Summerson will join him directly, and place herself under his protection to accompany him where he pleases. Mr. Bucket, satisfied, expresses high approval, and awaits her coming at the door. There he mounts a high tower in his mind, and looks out far and wide. Many solitary figures he perceives creeping through the streets, many solitary figures out on heaths and roads and lying under haystacks. But the figure that he seeks is not among them. Other solitaries he perceives, in nooks of bridges, looking over, and in shadowed places down by the river's level, and a dark, dark, shapeless object drifting with the tide, more solitary than all, clings with a drowning hold on his attention. Where is she? Living or dead, where is she? If, as he folds the handkerchief and carefully puts it up, it were able with an enchanted power to bring before him the place where she found it, and the night landscape near the cottage where it covered the little child, would he descry her there? On the waste, where the brick kilns are burning with a pale blue flare, where the straw roofs of the wretched huts in which the bricks are made are being scattered by the wind, where the clay and water are hard frozen, and the mill in which the gaunt blind horse goes round all day looks like an instrument of human torture, traversing this deserted, blighted spot, there is a lonely figure with a sad world to itself, pelted by the snow and driven by the wind, and cast out, it would seem, from all companionship. It is the figure of a woman, too, but it is miserably dressed, and no such clothes ever came through the hall and out at the great door of the Dedlock mansion. Chapter 57. Esther's Narrative. I had gone to bed and fallen asleep when my guardian knocked at the door of my room and begged me to get up directly. On my hurrying to speak to him and learn what had happened, he told me, after a word or two of preparation, that there had been a discovery at Sir Leicester Dedlock's, that my mother had fled, that a person was now at our door who was empowered to convey to her the fullest assurances of affectionate protection and forgiveness if he could possibly find her, and that I was sought for to accompany him in the hope that my entreaties might prevail upon her if his failed. Something to this general purpose I made out, but I was thrown into such a tumult of alarm and hurry and distress that in spite of every effort I could make to subdue my agitation, I did not seem, to myself, fully to recover my right mind until hours had passed. But I dressed and wrapped up expeditiously without waking Charlie or anyone, and went down to Mr. Bucket, who was the person entrusted with the secret. In taking me to him, my guardian told me this, and also explained how it was that he had come to think of me. Mr. Bucket, in a low voice, by the light of my guardian's candle, read to me in the hall a letter that my mother had left upon her table, and I suppose within 10 minutes of my having been aroused, I was sitting beside him, rolling swiftly through the streets. His manner was very keen, and yet considerate, when he explained to me that a great deal might depend on my being able to answer, without confusion, a few questions that he wished to ask me. These were, chiefly, whether I had had much communication with my mother, to whom he only referred as Lady Dedlock, when and where I had spoken with her last, and how she had become possessed of my handkerchief. When I had satisfied him on these points, he asked me particularly to consider, taking time to think, whether within my knowledge there was any one, no matter where, in whom she might be at all likely to confide under circumstances of the last necessity. I could think of no one but my guardian. But by and by I mentioned Mr. Boythorn. He came into my mind as connected with his old chivalrous manner of mentioning my mother's name, and with what my guardian had informed me of his engagement to her sister, and his unconscious connection with her unhappy story. My companion had stopped the driver while we held this conversation, that we might the better hear each other. He now told him to go on again, and said to me, after considering within himself for a few moments, that he had made up his mind how to proceed. He was quite willing to tell me what his plan was, but I did not feel clear enough to understand it. We had not driven very far from our lodgings when we stopped in a by-street at a public-looking place lighted up with gas. Mr. Bucket took me in and sat me in an armchair by a bright fire. It was now past one, as I saw by the clock against the wall. Two police officers, looking in their perfectly neat uniform, not at all like people who were up all night, were quietly writing at a desk, and the place seemed very quiet altogether, except for some beating and calling out at distant doors underground, to which nobody paid any attention. A third man in uniform, whom Mr. Bucket called and to whom he whispered his instructions, went out, and then the two others advised together while one wrote from Mr. Bucket's subdued dictation. It was a description of my mother that they were busy with, for Mr. Bucket brought it to me when it was done and read it in a whisper. It was very accurate indeed. The second officer, who had attended to it closely, then copied it out and called in another man in uniform. There were several in an outer room, who took it up and went away with it. All this was done with the greatest dispatch, and without the waste of a moment, yet nobody was at all hurried. As soon as the paper was sent out upon its travels, the two officers resumed their former quiet work of writing with neatness and care. Mr. Bucket thoughtfully came and warmed the soles of his boots, first one and then the other at the fire. "Are you well wrapped up, Miss Summerson?" he asked me as his eyes met mine. "It's a desperate sharp night for a young lady to be out in." I told him I cared for no weather and was warmly clothed. "It may be a long job," he observed, "but so that it ends well, never mind, miss."
"I pray to heaven it may end well," said I.
He nodded comfortingly.
"You see, whatever you do, don't you go and fret yourself. You keep yourself cool and equal for anything that may happen, and it'll be the better for you, the better for me, the better for Lady Dedlock, and the better for Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet."
He was really very kind and gentle, and as he stood before the fire, warming his boots and rubbing his face with his forefinger, I felt a confidence in his sagacity which reassured me. It was not yet a quarter to two when I heard horses' feet and the wheels outside.
"Now, Miss Summerson," said he, "we are off, if you please."
He gave me his arm, and the two officers courteously bowed me out, and we found at the door a phaeton or barouche with a postillion and post-horses. Mr. Bucket handed me in and took his own seat on the box. The man in uniform, who had sent to fetch this equipage, then handed him up a dark lantern at his request, and when he had given a few directions to the driver, we rattled away. I was far from sure that I was not in a dream. We rattled with great rapidity through such a labyrinth of streets that I soon lost all idea where we were, except that we had crossed and recrossed the river, and still seemed to be traversing a low-lying, waterside, dense neighbourhood of narrow thoroughfares checkered by docks and basins, high piles of warehouses, swing bridges and masts of ships. At length we stopped at the corner of a little slimy turning, which the wind from the river rushing up it did not purify, and I saw my companion, by the light of his lantern, in conference with several men, who looked like a mixture of police and sailors. Against the mouldering wall by which they stood there was a bill, on which I could discern the words, "Found Drowned." And this, and an inscription about drags, possessed me with the awful suspicion shadowed forth in our visit to that place. I had no need to remind myself that I was not there by the indulgence of any feeling of mine to increase the difficulties of the search, or to lessen its hopes, or enhance its delays. I remained quiet, but what I suffered in that dreadful spot I never can forget. And still it was like the horror of a dream. A man, yet dark and muddy, in long, swollen, sodden boots, and a hat like them, was called out of a boat and whispered with Mr. Bucket, who went away with him down some slippery steps, as if to look at something secret that he had to show. They came back, wiping their hands upon their coats, after turning over something wet, but thank God it was not what I feared. After some further conference, Mr. Bucket, whom everybody seemed to know and defer to, went in with the others at a door, and left me in the carriage, while the driver walked up and down by his horses to warm himself. The tide was coming in, as I judged from the sound it made, and I could hear it break at the end of the alley with a little rush towards me. It never did so, and I thought it did so hundreds of times in what can have been at the most a quarter of an hour, and probably was less, but the thought shuddered through me that it would cast my mother at the horse's feet. Mr. Bucket came out again, exhorting the others to be vigilant, darkened his lantern, and once more took his seat.
"Don't you be alarmed, Miss Summerson, on account of our coming down here," he said, turning to me. "I only want to have everything in train, and to know that it is in train, by looking after it myself. Get on, my lad."
We appeared to retrace the way we had come. Not that I had taken note of any particular objects in my perturbed state of mind, but judging from the general character of the streets. We called at another office or station for a minute and crossed the river again. During the whole of this time, and during the whole search, my companion, wrapped up on the box, never relaxed in his vigilance a single moment. But when we crossed the bridge, he seemed, if possible, to be more on the alert than before. He stood up to look over the parapet. He alighted and went back after a shadowy female figure that flitted past us, and he gazed into the profound black pit of water with a face that made my heart die within me. The river had a fearful look, so overcast and secret, creeping away so fast between the low flat lines of shore, so heavy with indistinct and awful shapes, both of substance and shadow, so death-like and mysterious. I have seen it many times since then, by sunlight and by moonlight, but never free from the impressions of that journey. In my memory, the lights upon the bridge are always burning dim. The cutting wind is eddying round the homeless woman whom we pass. The monotonous wheels are whirling on, and the light of the carriage lamps, reflected back, looks palely in upon me, a face rising out of the dreaded water. Clattering and clattering through the empty streets, we came at length from the pavement onto dark, smooth roads, and began to leave the houses behind us. After a while I recognised the familiar way to St. Albans. At Barnet fresh horses were ready for us, and we changed and went on. It was very cold indeed, and the open country was white with snow, though none was falling then. "An old acquaintance of yours, this road, Miss Summerson," said Mr. Bucket cheerfully. "Yes," I returned. "Have you gathered any intelligence?"
"None that can be quite depended on as yet," he answered, "but it's early times as yet."
He had gone into every late or early public house where there was a light. There were not a few at that time, the road being then much frequented by drovers, and had got down to talk to the turnpike keepers. I had heard him ordering drink and chinking money, and making himself agreeable and merry everywhere. But whenever he took his seat upon the box again, his face resumed its watchful, steady look, and he always said to the driver in the same business tone, "Get on, my lad." With all these stoppages, it was between 5 and 6 o'clock when we were yet a few miles short of St. Albans, when he came out of one of these houses and handed me in a cup of tea.
"Drink it, Miss Summerson. It'll do you good. You're beginning to get more yourself now, ain't you?"
I thanked him and said I hoped so.
"You was what you may call stunned at first," he returned.
"And Lord, no wonder." "Don't speak loud, my dear. It's all right. She's on ahead." I don't know what joyful exclamation I made, or was going to make, but he put up his finger and I stopped myself.
"Passed through here on foot this evening, about 8 or 9. I heard of her first at the archway toll over at Highgate, but couldn't make quite sure. Traced her all along, on and off, picked her up at one place and dropped her at another, and she's before us now, safe. Take hold of this cup and saucer, ostler. Now, if you wasn't brought up to the butter trade, look out and see if you can catch 1/2 a crown in your t'other hand. 1, 2, 3, and there you are. Now, my lad, try a gallop."
We were soon in St. Albans, and alighted a little before day, when I was just beginning to arrange and comprehend the occurrences of the night, and really to believe that they were not a dream. Leaving the carriage at the posting-house, and ordering fresh horses to be ready, my companion gave me his arm, and we went towards home.
"As this is your regular abode, Miss Summerson, you see," he observed, "I should like to know whether you've been asked for by any stranger answering the description, or whether Mr. Jarndyce has. I don't much expect it, but it might be."
As we ascended the hill, he looked about him with a sharp eye. The day was now breaking, and reminded me that I had come down it one night, as I had reason for remembering, with my little servant and poor Joe, whom he called Tuffy. I wondered how he knew that.
"When you passed a man upon the road, just yonder, you know," said Mr. Bucket.
"Yes, I remembered that, too, very well."
"That was me," said Mr. Bucket.
Seeing my surprise, he went on, "I drove down in a gig that afternoon to look after that boy. You might have heard my wheels when you come out to look after him yourself, for I was aware of you and your little maid going up when I was walking the horse down. Making an inquiry or two about him in the town, I soon heard what company he was in, and was coming among the brickfields to look for him, when I observed you bringing him home here."
"Had he committed any crime?" I asked.
"None was charged against him," said Mr. Bucket, coolly lifting off his hat. "But I suppose he wasn't over particular. No, what I wanted him for was in connection with keeping this very matter of Lady Dedlock quiet.
He had been making his tongue more free than welcome as to a small accidental service he had been paid for by the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn, and it wouldn't do at any sort of price to have him playing those games. So, having warned him out of London, I made an afternoon of it to warn him to keep out of it now he was away, and to go farther from it, and maintain a bright lookout that I didn't catch him coming back again. "Poor creature," said I. "Poor enough," assented Mr. Bucket, "and trouble enough, and well enough away from London or anywhere else. I was regularly turned on my back when I found him taken up by your establishment, I do assure you." I asked him why. "Why, my dear," said Mr. Bucket, "naturally there was no end to his tongue then. He might as well have been born with a yard and a half of it, and a remnant over." Although I remember this conversation now, my head was in confusion at the time, and my power of attention hardly did more than enable me to understand that he entered into these particulars to divert me. With the same kind intention, manifestly, he often spoke to me of indifferent things, while his face was busy with the one object that we had in view. He still pursued this subject as we turned in at the garden gate. "Ah," said Mr. Bucket, "here we are, and a nice retired place it is. Puts a man in mind of the country house in the woodpecker tapping, that was known by the smoke which so gracefully curled. They're early with the kitchen fire, and that denotes good servants. But what you've always got to be careful of with servants is who comes to see 'em. You never know what they're up to if you don't know that. And another thing, my dear, whenever you find a young man behind the kitchen door, you give that young man in charge on suspicion of being secreted in a dwelling-house with an unlawful purpose." We were now in front of the house. He looked attentively and closely at the gravel for footprints before he raised his eyes to the windows. "Do you generally put that elderly young gentleman in the same room when he's on a visit here, Miss Summerson?" he inquired, glancing at Mr. Skimpole's usual chamber. "You know Mr. Skimpole," said I. "Would you call him again?" returned Mr. Bucket, bending down his ear. "Skimpole, is it? I've often wondered what his name might be. Skimpole. Not John, I should say, nor Jacob." "Harold," I told him. "Harold, yes. He's a queer bird, is Harold," said Mr. Bucket, eyeing me with great expression. "He is a singular character," said I. "No idea of money," observed Mr. Bucket. "He takes it, though." I involuntarily returned for answer that I perceived Mr. Bucket knew him. "Why, now I'll tell you, Miss Summerson," he replied. "Your mind will be all the better for not running on one point too continually. And I'll tell you for a change. It was him as pointed out to me where Tuffy was. I made up my mind that night to come to the door and ask for Tuffy, if that was all. But willing to try a move or so first, if any such was on the board, I just pitched up a morsel of gravel at that window where I saw a shadow. As soon as Harold opens it, and I've had a look at him, thinks I, you're the man for me. So I smoothed him down a bit, about not wanting to disturb the family after they was gone to bed, and about its being a thing to be regretted that charitable young ladies should harbour vagrants. And then, when I pretty well understood his ways, I said I should consider a fiver note well bestowed if I could relieve the premises of Tuffy without causing any noise or trouble. Then, says he, lifting up his eyebrows in the gayest way, it's no use mentioning a fiver note to me, my friend, because I'm a mere child in such matters and have no idea of money. Of course, I understood what his taking it so easy meant, and being now quite sure he was the man for me, I wrapped the note round a little stone and threw it up to him. Well, he laughs and beams and looks as innocent as you like and says, 'But I don't know the value of these things. What am I to do with this?' 'Spend it, sir,' says I. 'But I shall be taken in,' he says. 'They won't give me the right change. I shall lose it. No use to me.' Lord, you never saw such a face as he carried it with. Of course, he told me where to find Tuffy, and I found him." I regarded this as very treacherous on the part of Mr. Skimpole towards my guardian, and as passing the usual bounds of his childish innocence. "Bounds, my dear?" returned Mr. Bucket. "Bounds? Now, Miss Summerson, I'll give you a piece of advice that your husband will find useful when you are happily married and have got a family about you. Whenever a person says to you that they are as innocent as can be in all concerning money, look well after your own money, for they are dead certain to collar it if they can. Whenever a person proclaims to you, 'In worldly matters I'm a child,' you consider that that person is only a crying off from being held accountable, and that you've got that person's number, and it's number one. Now, I'm not a poetical man myself, except in a vocal way when it goes round a company, but I'm a practical one, and that's my experience. So's this rule: fast and loose in one thing, fast and loose in everything. I never knew it fail. No more will you, nor no one. With which caution to the unwary, my dear, I'll take the liberty of pulling this here bell, and so go back to our business."
I believe it had not been for a moment out of his mind, any more than it had been out of my mind, or out of his face. The whole household were amazed to see me, without any notice at that time in the morning, and so accompanied, and their surprise was not diminished by my inquiries. No one, however, had been there. It could not be doubted that this was the truth. "Then, Miss Summerson," said my companion, "we can't be too soon at the cottage where those brickmakers are to be found. Most inquiries there I'll leave to you, if you'll be so good as to make them. The naturalist way is the best way, and the naturalist way is your own way." We set off again immediately. On arriving at the cottage, we found it shut up and apparently deserted, but one of the neighbours who knew me and who came out when I was trying to make someone hear informed me that the two women and their husbands now lived together in another house, made of loose, rough bricks, which stood on the margin of the piece of ground where the kilns were and where the long rows of bricks were drying. We lost no time in repairing to this place, which was within a few hundred yards, and as the door stood ajar, I pushed it open. There were only three of them sitting at breakfast, the child lying asleep on a bed in the corner. It was Jenny, the mother of the dead child, who was absent. The other woman rose on seeing me, and the men, though they were, as usual, sulky and silent, each gave me a morose nod of recognition. A look passed between them when Mr. Bucket followed me in, and I was surprised to see that the woman evidently knew him. I had asked leave to enter, of course. Liz, the only name by which I knew her, rose to give me her own chair, but I sat down on a stool near the fire, and Mr. Bucket took a corner of the bedstead. Now that I had to speak, and was among people with whom I was not familiar, I became conscious of being hurried and giddy. It was very difficult to begin, and I could not help bursting into tears. "Liz," said I, "I have come a long way in the night, and through the snow, to inquire after a lady—"
"Who has been here, you know?" Mr. Bucket struck in, addressing the whole group with a composed, propitiatory face. "That's the lady the young lady means. The lady that was here last night, you know."
"And who told you as there was anybody here?"
inquired Jenny's husband, who had made a surly stop in his eating to listen, and now measured him with his eye. "A person of the name of Michael Jackson, with a blue velveteen waistcoat and a double row of mother-of-pearl buttons," Mr. Bucket immediately answered.
"He had as good mind his own business, whoever he is," growled the man.
"He's out of employment, I believe," said Mr. Bucket, apologetically, for Michael Jackson, "and so gets talking."
The woman had not resumed her chair, but stood faltering with her hand upon its broken back, looking at me. I thought she would have spoken to me privately if she had dared. She was still in this attitude of uncertainty when her husband, who was eating with a lump of bread and fat in one hand and his clasp knife in the other, struck the handle of his knife violently on the table and told her with an oath to mind her own business, at any rate, and sit down.
"I should like to have seen Jenny very much," said I, "for I am sure she would have told me all she could about this lady, who I am very anxious indeed, you cannot think how anxious, to overtake. Will Jenny be here soon? Where is she?"
The woman had a great desire to answer, but the man, with another oath, openly kicked at her foot with his heavy boot. He left it to Jenny's husband to say what he chose, and after a dogged silence the latter turned his shaggy head towards me.
"I'm not partial to gentle folks coming into my place, as you've heard me say afore now, I think, miss. I let their places be, and it's curious they can't let my place be. There'd be a pretty shine if I was to go a-visiting them, I think. Howsoever, I don't so much complain of you as of some others, and I'm agreeable to make you a civil answer, though I give notice that I'm not a-going to be drawed like a badger. Will Jenny be here soon? No, she won't. Where is she? She's gone up to Lunnon."
"Did she go last night?" I asked.
"Did she go last night? Yeah, she went last night," he answered with a sulky jerk of his head.
"But was she here when the lady came? And what did the lady say to her? And where is the lady gone? I beg and pray you to be so kind as to tell me," said I, "for I am in great distress to know." "If my master would let me speak, and not say a word of harm," the woman timidly began.
"Your master," said her husband, muttering an imprecation with slow emphasis, "will break your neck if you meddle with what don't concern you."
After another silence, the husband of the absent woman, turning to me again, answered me with his usual grumbling unwillingness.
"Was Jenny here when the lady come?" "Yes, she was here when the lady come." "What did the lady say to her?" "Well, I'll tell you what the lady said to her. She said,
You remember me as come one time to talk to you about the young lady as been a visiting of you? You remember me as give you something handsome for a handkerchief what she had left? Ah, she remembered. So we all did. Well, then, was that young lady up at the house now? No, she weren't up at the house now. Well, then, looky here. The lady was upon a journey all alone, strange as we might think it, and could she rest herself where you're a-settin' for an hour or so? Yes, she could, and so she did. Then she went. It might be at 11:20, it might be at 12:20. We ain't got no watches yet to know the time by, nor yet clocks. Where did she go? I don't know where she goed. She went one way, and Jenny went another. One went right to London, and t'other went right from it. That's all about it. Ask this man. He heard it all, and see it all, he knows. The other man repeated, "That's all about it."
"Was the lady crying?" I inquired.
"Devil a bit," returned the first man. "Her shoes was the worst, and her clothes was the worst, but she weren't, not as I see."
The woman sat with her arms crossed and her eyes upon the ground. Her husband had turned his seat a little so to face her, and kept his hammer-like hand upon the table, as if it were in readiness to execute his threat if she disobeyed him. "I hope you will not object to my asking your wife," said I, "how the lady looked."
"Come then," he gruffly cried to her. "You hear what she says. Cut it short and tell her."
"Bad," replied the woman. "Pale and exhausted. Very bad."
"Did she speak much?"
"Not much, but her voice was hoarse."
She answered, looking all the while at her husband for leave.
"Was she faint?" said I. "Did she eat or drink here?"
"Go on," said the husband in answer to her look. "Tell her and cut it short."
"She had a little water, miss, and Jenny fetched her some bread and tea, but she hardly touched it."
"And when she went from here?"
I was proceeding, when Jenny's husband impatiently took me up.
"When she went from here, she went right away, nor by the high road. Ask on the road if you doubt me, and see if it weren't so. Now there's the end, that's all about it."
I glanced at my companion, and finding that he had already risen and was ready to depart, thanked them for what they had told me, and took my leave. The woman looked full at Mr. Bucket as he went out, and he looked full at her. "Now, Miss Summerson," he said to me as we walked quickly away, "they've got her ladyship's watch among 'em. That's a positive fact."
"You saw it?" I exclaimed.
"Just as good as saw it," he returned. "Else why should he talk about his 20 minutes past, and about his having no watch to tell the time by? 20 minutes. He don't usually cut his time so fine as that. If he comes to half hours, it's as much as he does. Now, you see, either her ladyship gave him that watch, or he took it. I think she gave it him. Now, what should she give it him for? What should she give it him for?"
He repeated this question to himself several times as we hurried on, appearing to balance between a variety of answers that arose in his mind.
"If time could be spared," said Mr. Bucket, "which is the only thing that can't be spared in this case, I might get it out of that woman. But it's too doubtful a chance to trust to under present circumstances. They're up to keeping a close eye upon her, and any fool knows that a poor creature like her, beaten and kicked and scarred and bruised from head to foot, will stand by the husband that ill-uses her through thick and thin. There's something kept back. It's a pity but what we had seen the other woman."
I regretted it exceedingly, for she was very grateful, and I felt sure would have resisted no entreaty of mine.
"It's possible, Miss Summerson," said Mr. Bucket, pondering on it, "that her ladyship sent her up to London with some word for you, and it's possible that her husband got the watch to let her go. It don't come out altogether so plain as to please me, but it's on the cards. Now, I don't take kindly to laying out the money of Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, on these roughs, and I don't see my way to the usefulness of it at present. No. So far our road, Miss Summerson, is forward, straight ahead, and keeping everything quiet."
We called at home once more, that I might send a hasty note to my guardian, and then we hurried back to where we had left the carriage. The horses were brought out as soon as we were seen coming, and we were on the road again in a few minutes. It had set in snowing at daybreak, and it now snowed hard. The air was so thick with the darkness of the day and the density of the fall that we could see but a very little way in any direction. Although it was extremely cold, the snow was but partially frozen, and it churned with a sound as if it were a beach of small shells under the hoofs of the horses into mire and water. They sometimes slipped and floundered for a mile together, and we were obliged to come to a standstill to rest them. One horse fell 3 times in this first stage, and trembled so and was so shaken that the driver had to dismount from his saddle and lead him at last. I could eat nothing and could not sleep,
and I grew so nervous under those delays and the slow pace at which we travelled that I had an unreasonable desire upon me to get out and walk. Yielding to my companion's better sense, however, I remained where I was. All this time, kept fresh by a certain enjoyment of the work in which he was engaged, he was up and down at every house we came to, addressing people whom he had never beheld before as old acquaintances, running in to warm himself at every fire he saw, talking and drinking and shaking hands at every bar and tap, friendly with every wagoner, wheelwright, blacksmith, and toll-taker, yet never seeming to lose time, and always mounting to the box again with his watchful, steady face and his business-like, "Get on, my lad!" When we were changing horses the next time, he came from the stable yard with a wet snow encrusted upon him and dropping off him, plashing and crashing through it to his wet knees as he had been doing frequently since we left St. Albans, and spoke to me at the carriage side. "Keep up your spirits. It's certainly true that she came on here, Miss Summerson. There's not a doubt of the dress by this time, and the dress has been seen here." "Still on foot," said I.